Today, the surgeon who found himself in Belmarsh maximum security prison after his patient died following an operation. And, in opinion, The Guardian's Gabby Hinsliff on whether civil servants should be apologising to Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn.
Every morning when we got out of the tube station, as we walked towards the Old Bailey, there'd be a big gang of photographers, and they were walking backwards with their cameras pointed towards me and my wife, and sometimes one or more of my children. And then we walked in, and the Old Bailey is a very intimidating place. Big, cavernous courtrooms, big building, wooden panels. It's a frightening place. The judge finished reading his sentencing remark. He told me to stand up. I did. And he said to me, David Selu, for the offence of unlawfully killing Mr. James Hughes, I sentence you to 2.5 years in prison. It was just the lowest point I could ever be in my life.
David Selu was a senior consultant specialising in gastrointestinal and colorectal surgery. He had just been found guilty of effectively killing his patient, James Hughes, because of delays in his medical treatment. From court, he was taken to a high-security prison that holds some of Britain's most notorious criminals. It was only after spending 15 months in jail that David Selu launched the appeal that cleared his name. Now he's speaking out. And as a new report delves into why ethnic minorities are twice as likely to face disciplinary action as their white counterparts, he accuses the profession of institutional racism. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, should doctors face jail when treatment goes wrong?
I was born in Sierra Leone, in West Africa, in a rural community. It was quite a lowly beginning. I didn't even know when I was born because there were no records of birth in my village at the time.
At first, David wasn't sent to school, but he taught himself to read and write. When a family friend noticed his potential, he began lessons, quickly excelling academically and eventually winning a place to study medicine in the UK. He took his first ever flight and landed in London in 1968.
It was a culture shock. The lights, the colours, the crowds, nothing that I'd ever seen before. I mean, Freetown was our city, but it was nothing compared to what I was about to encounter in London.
You became a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Was it your dream career?
Yes, it was. It was a great moment when I was finally pronounced a doctor. In the late 70s, early 80s, I met my wife. She was a young nurse in Hammersmith.
Catherine,
yes. We got married and had 4 children.
Can you tell me about the day when your career changed forever?
I'd had a pretty long day, and I finished that day working in the private hospital. I was doing a clinic. An orthopaedic surgeon colleague of mine knocked on my door and he said, David, can you see somebody for me when you finish? He's a 66-year-old man. I did a total knee replacement on him 5 days ago. He's now complaining of pains in his tummy.
That patient was James Hughes, a retired builder from Ireland, and David suspected that his stomach pain may have been caused by a perforated bowel.
That's the reason I decided to get him to have a CT scan first thing the following morning. That CT scan, of course, didn't happen as quickly as I'd hoped. It took place at about midday the next day.
The events of the next few hours would be pored over. David says he asked for blood tests and antibiotics to be given, but that didn't happen. He says he wanted to operate on Friday afternoon, but delays in booking a theatre and anaesthetist, as well as other complications, meant the procedure did not begin until the early hours of Saturday morning.
This man was a lot sicker than even we had realised. there was quite a lot more bleeding than I'd anticipated, in part due to the fact that he had a liver problem, which had hitherto been not discovered.
The difficult and complicated operation stretched through the night, finally finishing at 4 a.m. on Saturday morning. It appeared to have gone to plan, but it was soon clear that Mr. Hughes was seriously ill.
On the Sunday, I got a call from the senior intensivist with whom I'd operated two nights before. And he said to me, "David, I've got bad news." And I knew really from as soon as he said that, expecting the worst, Mr. Hughes has just died.
Mr. Hughes had died from multiple organ failure. Because of the unexpected and unexplained nature of his death, the hospital launched an internal investigation into David's conduct, which heavily criticised him.
You know, they were looking for a scapegoat and they found it in me.
What was not revealed to the coroner who oversaw the inquest into James Hughes' death a few months later was a second internal investigation exposing systemic failures in the hospital's own procedures.
I was at the mercy of the coroner. He was very, very awkward towards me. He stopped the inquest, obviously based on a very one-sided sort of view of what had happened during this case, and he decided that he would pass the papers on to the police for further investigation.
That is so unusual for a doctor to be criminally investigated for healthcare decisions. And next thing, you're being questioned by the police. It must have been frightening.
Frightening is more than frightening. I was called to Harrow Police Station. I was interviewed into the night and I didn't have any notes on me. I was being asked questions aggressively. And that, incidentally, that report was read out in court. And any inconsistency was jumped upon by the prosecution saying, he's a liar. You see, you said this then and now you're saying something slightly different and so on. But, you know, human memory is frail.
It's really rare for surgeons to be charged for something that happens on the operating table. And yet in July 2012, more than 2 years since he had operated on James Hughes, David faced a prosecution for gross negligence manslaughter. He was effectively being accused of killing his patient because of a delay in getting Mr. Hughes to theatre and for failing to ensure the timely provision of antibiotics. I mean, you write about medics wanting to take their own lives in these situations. Was there ever a point where you thought you couldn't carry on?
Yes, I nearly did get to that point. I didn't, because I had the support of my family and friends, and they rallied around me and gave me really very, very good support.
And by this point, you were being hounded by the media as well.
Yeah, I was. There was one day when, after I'd had the police interview, even before I heard what the outcome of that interview was to be, somebody from one of the newspapers knocked on my door, pulled out a microphone, shoved it into my face and said, "We hear you being investigated for manslaughter. What do you have to say?"
Do you remember any headlines that particularly hurt you?
Surgeon abandons dying patient. Patient dies in severe pain and so on, none of which, of course, was true. But this was all going on at the time that I was being investigated and into my trial. This was all going on. It makes it extremely difficult to defend yourself fairly when there were all of these headlines.
During this period, David was banned from any medical work as he waited for his trial to begin.
Well, the trial took place over about 6 weeks. There were lots of medical issues, which in my view were very poorly explained to a lay jury. At the end of the trial, the judge gave the instructions to them. They came back the next day. They deliberated for most of the day. Then they came back at the end, and they handed a piece of paper, which in summary said, "My Lord, we don't really understand this case." So he merely repeated some of what he'd previously said and gave no clear guidance to the jury. So that was the sum total of the direction that the jury got. which in my view was totally, totally unfair. I'd more or less resigned myself to the fact that I was going to be found guilty. One, because of the colour of my skin. I think we know that if you are from an ethnic background, you're more likely to be convicted in a court of law. The way that the prosecution had made this case, they merely used emotionalism. Here was a 66-year-old man, previously fit. He comes into hospital to have a knee operation, and then he dies. Now, what they didn't tell the jury was that the condition from which this man died naturally kills about a third of the people who get it. So it's a highly serious condition.
David endured a nail-biting wait for the jury to make its decision. Eventually, everyone called back into court, where in front of a packed public gallery, David was found guilty of gross negligence manslaughter by 10 to 2.
I showed no outward emotion simply because I just didn't have the strength. Every emotion that I'd felt prior to the conclusion of this case. So I really think I couldn't have sunk any lower. After the judge gave his sentencing remarks and then said, the final thing he said was, David Selu, I sentence you to 2.5 years in prison for unlawfully killing Mr. Hughes. I was handcuffed. I had up to now been doing my best to really make very little eye contact with my family before I got out of the dock to go down the steps. And that's when I looked at them. And I could clearly see how upset they were. It was only a very, very fleeting glance. And I could hear them crying. And that was very haunting. It was very upsetting.
What was it like being led down and travelling in a police van?
The police van, it's a cell on wheels. It's, in my view, an inhumane way of transporting people. It's a little cubicle, no seatbelts, frosted windows, press standing outside trying to get a glimpse of how things were. And they were simply running, speeding to get from A to B. You know, you were locked in the cell. And I mean, if there was ever an accident, everybody in there except the driver would die.
And they took you to Belmarsh, which holds some of the most dangerous criminals in the country. What was that like?
When I went into the prison cell, I looked in. It was 5 steps by 3. And that's half the size of a domestic toilet. And it had 3 people inside, a bunk bed and 1 single bed. There was a toilet to one side of the room where we all went. As a bowel surgeon, I know that the average number of times that people go to toilet is between 3 times a day to 3 times a week. I prayed that nobody pooed 3 times a day. We ate in that room. We slept in there. We were locked up in there sometimes for 22 hours a day. That was inhumane. That is against United Nations Convention, a convention to which the UK is signed up to. People whose criminal histories I did not know, but I discovered some of them were terrorists, some of them were rapists. That's where I was. I don't know why I deserve to be there. That's when I cried.
Did the other prisoners say anything to you?
Yes, they were very civil. We tried to be as civil as we could. And actually one of them was very helpful because he'd been in prison several times. So if I ever needed any information, he was the one to talk to. And he'd say, oh, you do this, you do that, and this is what's going to happen tomorrow. I needed somebody like that to really guide me through the prison system because nobody else did.
Your family's fight to clear your name had begun, but you served 15 months, one of which was in Belmarsh. You hadn't cleared your name when you were released. How did you feel then? What did it feel like to be free?
Well, I wasn't really free because I had a criminal sentence now, remember. You know, I came out, I was no longer incarcerated, but I was not a free man. There were things I couldn't do until I'd completely served my 2.5 years. I spent half of my time in prison, but the remaining time was under restrictions. I couldn't go abroad. I wasn't allowed to drink alcohol. I wasn't allowed to access the internet. Freedom, well, only in the sense that I was no longer held in the confines of a prison, but that was not really freedom.
David's prison nightmare was over, but he remained determined to clear his name. A former colleague and campaigner, Dr. Jenny Vaughan, led the appeal. It was at this point that they discovered that the hospital had a second report into what happened that had never been released.
After Jenny Vaughan made all the investigations that there had been a root cause analysis that we didn't know about, but unfortunately we discovered through our lawyers that we were not allowed to produce that in our defence during the appeal. It was a very powerful document. It might have made a difference to our trial, but at this stage, the reason that the appeal succeeded was because the judge had failed adequately to instruct the jury. The jury just did not understand what it is that they were adjudicating on.
And it wasn't just the criminal conviction being overturned. You were also tried by the General Medical Council with a much lower evidence threshold, and you were cleared. In your book, you mention noticing that all other doctors in front of the regulator had foreign names.
Yes. All the doctors that have been convicted of gross negligence manslaughter since about 2012, five of them have all been from ethnic minorities. The sixth one was a lady who actually happens to be Spanish, so she's not Anglo-Saxon.
It's clear that you believe that that's racism.
Well, how else can you explain it? Things that are said about us is, oh, they don't understand our culture, they don't understand our language. That's the reason that they end up in this kind of scenario. Rubbish. You know, I've lived here. We've worked in the same hospitals as they have. Some of us have gone to the same medical schools as they have. Even those who've worked, who trained abroad, are required to train stringently to get to the positions that they get to in some of their best hospitals. So there can only be one explanation for it. It can only be because of their colour of their skin.
Last week, a report commissioned by the GMC into why ethnic minority doctors are so much more likely to face disciplinary action found they were too often treated as outsiders by NHS bosses and peers. One of the authors admitted that racial discrimination does play a part, saying, "I would not say it can all be explained by racism." What happened to David had a huge impact on his family, but it particularly affected his youngest son, James, who was studying medicine.
One point, he came to me and my wife and said, "Mum, Dad, I don't want to go to do medicine." "Dad, when we were growing up, you devoted your whole life to medicine. You missed most of our sports days, our speech days. You were hardly there. Why? Because you were busy treating your patients. You gave your life almost exclusively and in a brilliant way to medicine. On account of one single incident, which wasn't even your fault, you get humiliated to this degree. And you've been racially treated, racially abused in your profession too. If this is what medicine is for, it's not for me." And James gave up medicine. He's never stepped foot in a hospital.
Is he angry?
I think he's sad rather than angry. Like me, it's not really anger, because one of the things I tried not to do is to let anger consume me.
And how do you feel now?
Well, I obviously feel relieved that I've been over it, but the collateral damage, if you put it that way, is still ongoing, and it will probably never really expire. Obviously, I feel sorry for my patient, because at the end of it all, what this is all about, what this should all be about, should be patient safety.
Has James Hughes' family ever said anything since your conviction was quashed?
Not directly to me, but they are obviously disappointed that even though I've been punished for this man's death, they've not really had any clear explanations, therefore, as to why he died.
And just very finally, this is difficult, isn't it? Because on the one hand, your case is a terrible miscarriage of justice. And on the other hand, patients deserve a right to accountability if things go wrong within hospital settings.
Yes.
Have you thought hard about what the balance is that needs to be struck on this issue?
What we've got to get away from is this blame business. We've got to have a system where, for the sake of accountability, for the sake of our patients, if something goes wrong, we can hold up our hands and say, look, we're sorry, this is how it happened. We'll try and learn from it and try for it not to happen. Look, people are not looking for compensation often when they bring out these cases. They want a clear explanation as to what went wrong, an assurance that this won't happen to anybody else. That's really what people hold out for when things go wrong in medicine.
So create an environment in which doctors are able to admit to mistakes if they make them.
Yes.
But do not put those same doctors in the criminal courts.
Because it's counterproductive. Look, what has medicine, the law, and the general public gained from my imprisonment? Nothing.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anushka.
David Selu's book, Did He Save Lives? A Surgeon's Story, is published tomorrow, the 4th of July. BMI Healthcare, who run the Clementine Churchill Hospital where David worked, said in a statement, "Our thoughts remain with the family and friends of Mr. Hughes. We provided all information requested of us by the coroner and to the police after the coroner chose to refer the case for investigation. Neither BMI Healthcare nor the Clementine Churchill Hospital were involved in the criminal investigation nor the trial beyond providing copies of documents on request and facilitating police interviews of staff. The General Medical Council stressed that it had no role in criminal cases against doctors, adding, however, we do know that Black, Asian and minority ethnic doctors are more likely to be referred to the GMC by their employers than white doctors. This results in more BAME doctors being investigated and receiving sanctions. They pointed to the report they commissioned into looking at this question that we spoke about in the piece. Coming up, when civil servants gossip about incoming political leaders. Now, it is the job of British civil servants to work for politicians in a neutral manner, which is why the Labour Party reacted with fury when senior officials were quoted in a newspaper discussing rumours relating to the physical and mental health of their leader. They called it undemocratic and unconstitutional. The Guardian's Gabby Hinsliff responds.
So the Times ran a story last Saturday suggesting that there were doubts in Whitehall about Jeremy Corbyn's fitness, either mentally or physically, to be Prime Minister, and quoting lots of unnamed sources, not just civil servants, but also MPs and other sort of Labour sources, coming up with stories about his alleged inability to remember things or inability to grasp a brief, perhaps, at which point all hell broke loose, obviously. A lot of people saw that as extremely ageist because it focused on whether or not Jeremy Corbyn was slightly too old to be Prime Minister, saw it as an invasion of privacy, and the Labour Party objected very strongly on the grounds that some of the rumours quoted, there's a long-standing rumour that has been doing the rounds for a while at Westminster, although not previously surfaced in print, that Jeremy Corbyn had had a mini stroke earlier this year. The Leader's Office categorically denies that that is the case. The Labour Party was angry. They obviously refuted claims that Jeremy Corbyn was in some sense unfit to hold office, and there were lots of talk about how, you know, generally fit and healthy he is. He runs every day, he cycles a lot, and he's a teetotal vegetarian, you know, absolutely fit as a fiddle, all of this stuff. But then went on to broader concerns about whether these discussions should have been taking place in the first place. And then Downing Street issued a statement suggesting that it would be inappropriate and unacceptable for comments of this sort to have been made or briefed to the press. So they're not just talking there about the appropriateness of civil servants briefing journalists, but the appropriateness of making these kind of comments in the first place. And that's obviously goes to the heart of concerns about civil service neutrality. I do think Jeremy Corbyn is entitled to an apology for the fact that senior civil servants spoke to journalists, which they're not supposed to do. And yes, of course it happens. I think where things get more difficult is this suggestion that somehow civil servants are not entitled to talk, even in private, even amongst themselves, about any concerns they might have about an incoming prime minister. So let's assume that we're talking about a fictional prime minister here about whom there have been concerns. I think it's almost impossible on a practical basis to prevent civil servants swapping stories about an incoming potential boss in the same way that in any walk of life, if you or I had a new boss, we'd all compare what we knew and compare notes about them before they started. But I also think there's a broader question about what civil servants should do if they have concerns about an incoming administration. We've seen what happened in the US, and we may be looking in a few months' time at a British administration that is hell-bent on a no-deal Brexit. At that point, you know, the job of civil servants is to do what politicians tell them to do and put their personal misgivings to one side. There are times when that's more difficult than others, and we may be entering a period of government where, you know, that is extremely difficult for some civil servants. What you have to recognise is the whole of Westminster, not just civil servants, but journalists, MPs, researchers, anyone who works in Westminster, is constantly trading gossip the entire time, is constantly swapping stories, is constantly sharing information about the main players in politics. Of course, people talk about, you know, at the moment it's all about Boris Johnson and whether or not his divorce and his relationship with his girlfriend, what impact that has on his sort of state of mind as he approaches being prime minister. You know, there have been times when people were having similar discussions about Theresa May's diabetes, which is perhaps why Downing Street responded as strongly as it did. These conversations go on all the time. They're impossible to prevent. And the assumption of the Labour Party is sometimes that the establishment is uniquely determined to keep them out of power and desperate to keep Jeremy Corbyn out of Downing Street. Jeremy Corbyn is by no means the only party leader to have faced these kind of rumours. He won't be the last, he wasn't the first. This is a fairly normal part of how Westminster operates. And if you are aspiring to be Prime Minister, to run the country, to have that ultimate power, you can expect people to ask some embarrassing sometimes questions about you, I think.
That was Gabby Hinsliff. You can read her piece on this at theguardian.com. That's it for today. My thanks to David Sellew and Gabby Hinsliff. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Zoe Gelber. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.